Welcome to the Pearson Future Ready Today podcast. My name is Andy Woods, an ex-science teacher and now a product manager for Pearson. Today I'm speaking of Rachel Vecht, founder of Educating Matters, who offer parent coaching, corporate seminars and practical parenting tips. She focuses her support on the workplace, schools and at home to parents and carers. In this episode, Rachel talks about how her experience of being a teacher and a parent have shaped her views on parental involvement, future skills and employee engagement. She shares how she's managing her own business during COVID-19 lockdown with four children at home and gives some guidance to parents and carers during this time. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, hello.
Hi, hope you're well today. What I'd like to start off with is just more of a general question, really. Can you tell me about your career so far and how did you get to where you are now? And that might be a long answer, but please just give us an overview.
I'll try and keep it brief. So I always wanted to be a primary school teacher from about the age of seven, like lots of little children. So I want to be a mummy and a teacher or whatever. And so I taught for about 7 years, a bit of time in the state sector and independent. And whilst I was teaching, it was in the 90s, when the government introduced something called the National Literacy Strategy. And I was responsible for literacy and running a lot of training sessions for staff. But also I felt that parents were underused as a resource. If they had more of a sense of what was going on in school, they could support my work as a teacher at home. So I used to run quite a lot of curriculum evenings for parents. And my particular focus was literacy. Then I was pregnant with my first child. So this is about 19 years ago. And I wrote a course outside of schools for parents on how children learn to read and what is the role of a parent at home in instilling in children love of books. And it wasn't my intention, the whole thing just evolved. But in one session, there was a dad there who was an investment banker, and he said, "You know what, this has been so helpful. I thought I was just saying what was really obvious. Any chance you can come into my office and give this talk for my colleagues that are parents, because they'll never have time to do it in school." So I was like, okay. And that's what I've been doing ever since. So everything evolved from there. I mean, most of my time is spent speaking to parents in a corporate setting. But outside the workplace, I also run parenting courses and do a lot of one-to-one consultations. But what I provide has just evolved from what parents need. So after reading, it was like, well, how on earth do they teach maths? And how do I choose a school for my child? And how do I get my kid to do their homework? And what do I do when siblings are fighting? And how do I prepare my child for university? And the list just went on and on until I had about 40 different topics on everything related to parenting and educating children. Plus, along that journey, I had four children. So it was very much drawing on my experiences in the classroom, but also the practical experience of being a parent, and then understanding what teachers can get kids to do is very different to what parents can get their children to do. And I didn't understand that until I'd had children myself.
Yeah, I'm definitely feeling that myself as a former teacher, but also trying to educate my own children as a common theme I think I'm hearing from parents. I mean, why do you think that there's this kind of barrier between school and parents to a certain extent? And do you think it's differed in terms of, you've obviously been in the independent sector and in the state sector. Are there any big major differences between those sectors in terms of engagement or in terms of different challenges you've met? Because you've had experience in both of those areas.
Yeah, and I purposely decided, the majority of my time was spent in the state sector, but I felt like I wanted to get into an insight into what parents are actually paying for. And I was a bit curious about how the independent sector functions as well. And I also, by the way, used to train student teachers who were learning on the job. So I had quite a bit of experience in that. I think in terms of engagement, I don't like to make generalizations. So I've met lots of parents in both sectors that can be very involved and quite disengaged. I feel like in independent schools that perhaps the schools are a little bit more accountable to parents, because obviously parents are paying the fees. So maybe parents' voice can be a little bit stronger, but it really varies from one school to another. I've met plenty of parents in independent schools that are working full time and are not that engaged either. So
yeah, so different kind of problems, but maybe the engagement could be minimal, but for different reasons, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. In terms of your company, Educating Matters, what is the main focus of your company? Can you tell us a bit about your company? And I know you've kind of touched on a little bit already, but could you kind of flesh that out a little bit and tell us a bit more about your company?
Yeah, well, my overarching aim is just to give parents or anybody with a caring responsibility for a child, so it could be grandparents, godparents, aunts, anyone, some really practical, realistic advice on how they can support their children. Because being a parent is the most important job you ever have, but we probably have the least amount of training. So based on my, what is it now, 25 years of experience, is trying to guide parents on all sorts of, but essentially how to get the best out of your child and how to approach that. So it might be parents who are struggling with the transition of becoming a parent for a first time. They could have been fine until they got to the teenage years. But it's really, I don't have a set kind of thing that I provide. It's understanding what are the challenges a particular company is facing. Who have they outlined as a group that really needs support? It could be the dads, it could be people returning from maternity leave. It varies in one company to the next. But just, and the medium in which I give that support has also really varied and evolved over time. So originally it was all like, a 1 hour lunchtime seminar, but I've been doing videos for global clients that you can access wherever you are in the world, and it's like 3 or 4 minutes, or it might be an article, or it might be, I do like all day clinics where individuals get half hour slots. So it's being quite creative about how we provide that support in different ways.
And in this COVID-19 situation, when we're recording this podcast, I guess getting firsthand and sensitive advice you give in terms of your homeschooling of your own children, and you really have, just like a lot, lots of other parents, firsthand experience about educating your own children. How have you found that, in a sense? I know your children, are they kind of mostly teenagers now? Have you found that process, and how have you approached that management of the home learning situation?
Okay, well, to be honest, the beginning was very tricky for me because I was very ill with the virus for about 3 weeks and went into self-isolation before the rest of the country. So I was really sick. I have 4 children. I run my own business, and I was getting this barrage of emails from my existing corporate clients in all sorts of sectors saying, help, help, we've got to support these parents that are at home. And, I was creating content whilst lying in my bed with a high fever, and also thinking, how am I going to get food? But things have calmed down, and we found our rhythm. I think the big challenge that I'm hearing, because in the space of 8 weeks, I have now spoken to thousands of parents, like some of the webinars have had 1,000 people dialing in. It's managing everyone's varying needs and getting some space and time for yourself. I think there's been a lot of difficult emotions. So you've got anxiety and frustration and uncertainty. And it's the first time where we don't have the answers. Like we don't even know how long we're going to be in lockdown for. So, and I think in the beginning, I was creating this content and living through it. And I remember I was setting quite unrealistic goals and expectations. It's a bit like New Year's resolutions. So I was going to tidy every cupboard in my house and sort out a 2-year backlog of photos, which 8 weeks down the line still hasn't happened. So it's managing all of that, and also being realistic. Like my company is called Educating Matters. I'm a teacher. Of course, I care about education, but the priority is, being safe, healthy, that the children's mental health and socially and emotionally are in a good place ahead of their education. And actually, on my blog, I wrote this, what are the positives of this situation? And just doing that exercise helped me feel better, because my top one as a mother of 3 teenagers is there is no FOMO. That is just fabulous. So no one's missing out on anything. And I think one thing a lot of parents worry about is this feeling of entitlement that their children have. Now my kids would just, if they were able to go to a supermarket, I don't even take them, but it would be like the most exciting thing, just being able to hug their grandmother or sit in Starbucks. These things they used to take for granted will be so much more meaningful. And just having that extended time together and that connection with family and that sense of community, and the fact that life is a bit simpler and slower. Steve Biddulph's written a book, Raising Boys, and he says rushing is the enemy of love, which used to make me feel really guilty. But it's, in a way, we're busier than ever, but having that time to kind of slow down and be with your family.
Yeah, I think it's also from a personal point of view, in terms of, yeah, you say it's, it forces you together, literally. And as you say, or many people say, in terms of the time you spend your kids, may be things you prioritize differently. And just going for a simple walk with a child has a big impact on that child, and something that we probably don't prioritize when our day to day kind of lives. I was interested to think or get your thoughts on how much routine plays a part in terms of trying to educate children. I mean, what I have done in terms of our own children, we've set some kind of structure whereby the Monday to Friday has some kind of things that happen every day. For example, we try and get them to do that, because mine are younger, you know, we try and get them to do Joe Wicks for a bit, and then they do, you know, English, maths, etc. And putting that in place for children. What do you think about, because I know in terms of some other parents I've spoken to, some parents have even like put their children in school uniform to get them in the zone of doing schoolwork. I mean, there's a debate about that and whether that's too strict. What do you think about the ways that parents should be approaching homeschooling? You know, how far is too far in terms of strictness and regime, and do we need to be a bit easy on ourselves as well, because we're not teachers, as it were, even, you know, what do you think about that?
Whenever I guide parents, I'm very much into positive parenting and also not being too prescriptive. So every parent is the expert on their child. So different children need different things. So if you've got a child who's autistic, they have to have routine and structure. Another child maybe doesn't need that. And even within one family, kids function differently. Personally, I hate this term homeschooling, because I think it creates a lot of pressure for parents. And what is going on now is not homeschooling. You know, people who choose to homeschool their child have made a conscious choice to do that. They're probably not holding down a full-time job, and homeschool kids are not at home all day. My kids are obviously older and a bit more independent, but even though I'm a teacher, I'm not actually teaching my children. What I'm trying to do is set them up for success by providing the right environment to enable them to get the best out of the support the school is providing. So obviously everybody strives on a bit of routine and structure, but some kids need more than others. And I have been saying to parents, because I've been doing talks just on how to create that routine and structure, it's about getting your child's buy-in. So even if they're only three, you know, would you prefer to brush your teeth before or after you get dressed? Or do you want to do your counting first or your reading, so that they feel they have some choice? And I've adjusted what I'm doing for different ages. So for my 10-year-old, I am actually teaching her quite a bit of maths, because she was struggling with that, and she's really working well on it. My 13-year-old, it's just about supporting her initially with her time and organization management. My 17-year-old is fairly independent, but I'm giving her a lot of support emotionally, helping her when she's procrastinating and to feel motivated. And my next one is working out what he can do now his A-levels are cancelled. I did just see Pearson's Learning Hub, because I looked Pearson's up before the call. I'm going to check that out. But finding something for someone who's got nothing to do till October is,
yes, know, no,
I'm
no,
waiting for it to come from him rather than me dictating.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think what you say about giving children choice resonates with me, in sense of that I'm thinking about my own situation. I've got two younger and one slightly older, in terms of that idea you were talking about. In terms of the younger ones, make them do the Joe Wicks thing just as a starter. But I might say to my older son, you haven't done that, so you need to come out for a walk later, because it's exercise, but it's a choice within that choice grid, if you see what I mean. There is an expectation that this needs to be done, as you say. But I like your idea of giving a flexibility within that network, and especially in a unique situation where, you know, parents are managing that. I mean, that's the extra challenge, I guess, because you talk about homeschooling and it's not a natural choice in a sense, because it's number one, you've got perhaps the expectation of, or my wife feels, I think, in terms of that we've got responsibility to help them more, whereas when they get to senior school, think that, you know, they've got the work and they can be more independent. How have you found generally, if we take the, say, the children out of the equation, so to speak, so when they're back at school and there's more working at home for people, how do you think that might change in terms of people and their careers? What lessons can we learn in terms of whether home working is a good or a bad thing in your eyes? Do you think companies will change their aspect?
So, firstly, one lesson I've learned is how unbelievably adaptable and resilient human beings are. So everybody has learned quite creative ways to work remotely and still feel part of a team because everyone's now experienced it for themselves. So even if some people go back to being in an office and others decide I can work productively from home, we know a lot more now about how to kind of nurture team morale. Even, I mean, this is how I met Pearson. I was on a panel last week and I've appeared on many panels with huge audiences, but I've never actually been able to look in the eyes of the people I'm on the panel with. You're always on a stage sitting next to them. And using, you know, Zoom and actually seeing six faces in front of me, in a weird way, was much more connected than I would be sitting next to them. So that need for face-to-face connection, you know, I work with investment banks and law firms and people that are used to traveling all over the world for an hour's meeting. So that need to travel, which is great for the environment, and the long commute. And I think we're moving away, hopefully, from this culture of presenteeism and focusing much more on outcomes and contribution and giving people a sense of empowerment and control to choose. I mean, flexibility over salary is becoming the new currency. So people being able to adopt different working patterns. And I would say not only for parents. So I'm hoping one of the outcomes is going to accelerate this culture of agile working. So everyone is in a happier place and more productive at work when they have the time to pursue their own interests. So it could be, I know you want to write a book or climb a mountain or be in a band or volunteer or do art classes. But then when you're actually in work, when you've had that chance for that space to do something else, that's very powerful. And I think there's a lot more emphasis on inclusion and realizing that everyone has their different way of functioning and we need to respect and honor that. So I hope it's going to be a mindset shift.
Yeah, do you think that it's going to give a much greater help to care those with caring responsibilities? And in the past, and this is not the case now, obviously, but there tends to be a bit divided. My wife sometimes says on the train, you know, she doesn't see enough women coming off the train in terms of when I'm commuting. And will that flexibility, you think, really, I think, empower women more in terms of giving them that flexibility so they can be present at home if they need to be, or when they're at work, that they're at work? Do you think that's really going to help those with caring responsibilities get a lot more out of their work life, do you think?
I very much hope so. But we always think about women needing the flexibility. The big pattern that I've seen over the last few years, and I do a lot of sessions just for dads, is that fathers are striving for that flexibility just as much as mothers. I know the take up of paternity leave is still quite low because they're worried about the how it's going to affect career progression and how they're going to be perceived. So culturally, it's still difficult. But I think to support mothers, we actually need to make it become more acceptable for dads to take that extended leave or to work, you know, 4 days a week instead of five or a few days from home. Everyone's rethinking their values and purpose. So maybe even a dad that didn't consider doing that, now that he's been around his kids, might be thinking, actually, I would like to pick them up from school or actually be there for dinner twice a week or something.
Yeah, of course. And I think that might obviously lead to a more flexible approach. And I think that would be a positive thing that comes out of there in terms of making it a good fit for whatever the situation is, as you say, whether it's the woman wants to be at more work or vice versa. So I think that's really important. I hope that does change the way companies view it. Yeah. I was going to move on to now talking about parental involvement in a child's education, because you say that's one of the most important things, obviously, for a child to be successful. And I'm going to ask you a general question, which may be difficult to answer, I don't know, but how much is the right amount of support to give a child? What are your thoughts on how much you should support a child and how much you should give them independence? And maybe that depends on the age. What were your thoughts generally about
that is a great question. So for 19 years, the strapline at the bottom of every email I've sent is parents are a child's first and most important teacher. And I don't mean teacher in the way, you know, what they're doing at school. But I would say it's getting this balance between not being a helicopter parent and hovering over your child. So it's being involved in terms of supporting and encouraging, and with regards to school, modelling a passion for learning and being informed, showing an interest, knowing what's going on, supporting the school, you know, understanding their policies and approach to reinforce it at home. But that word independence is crucial. So they have to, I think the most important thing, and that's hopefully another benefit of now, is that they're being independent learners. And I've been saying to parents, because I've been doing sessions on what does homeschooling mean, just put aside your traditional view of what an education is. And I've actually highlighted four areas that parents can be teaching kids that they learn a bit in school, but not as much. So firstly, it's the practical life skills. So I don't know how many parents of 18-year-olds say, oh my God, my child doesn't know how to put a washing machine on, and I haven't taught them how to manage money, and they've no idea how to cook a meal, and now they're going to university. So all of that, whatever age your child, even if they're two, ask yourself, what am I doing for my child that they could be doing themselves? Then there's everything you're teaching them about values. So this is your opportunity when you spend so much time with your kids to role model, talk about the values like respect and kindness and work ethic and independence and confidence. And that is your main role as a parent, to instill values in your children. Schools do that as well, but you have a much bigger part to play. Then there is what you contribute to their emotional intelligence. And for me, EQ is way more important than IQ. So I've done loads of talks in the past on resilience. What they're going through now, the number of disappointments they've had to deal with, anything can happen later down the line. They'll be like, well, I dealt with COVID-19 and, you know, my birthday party's cancelled and interrailing is cancelled and all these things they're looking forward to. So teaching them self-regulation and managing and articulating emotions. And the fourth area for me is the study and work skills that they will need throughout their lives. So what they're learning about organizing their time, how to manage their workspace, what do you do when you're procrastinating, how do you keep yourself focused when you haven't got a teacher and your classmates on top of you, how do you keep yourself motivated? These are challenges that adults face. And they've had a lot of practice now on developing some of those really important work skills.
Yeah, I was going to talk, you talk about persistence. It's quite interesting in terms of, and a question thinking about whether we allow our children to fail at things and when we should say you've got to carry on, when you've got to say stop. I think about my own children in this sense that it might be a club, there might be judo or something. And one son would say, I've had enough of this. I want to, you know, make him finish at a certain point. You know, at what point do you, what is the best thing in terms of saying, okay, you've done enough? When is the right time to step in and be resilient and say, actually, you've got to push through this barrier, and over the other side is you know, something better? And maybe that is a difficult question to answer. What do you think about failure and letting kids being independent and trying to also promote grit to a certain extent without being too kind?
So I'm a massive proponent of that concept of grit. I've just forgotten the name of my favourite book about grit. And also this idea of a growth mindset that comes. Oh, it's Angela Duckworth wrote the book on grit, and Carol Dweck, this whole growth mindset piece. So I say to my kids, fail stands for first attempt in learning. You cannot learn unless you make mistakes. If you read about any, I don't know, Olympic sportsman, politician, musician, they've all made mistakes along the way. And it's much more about the effort and the persevering than just kind of naturally being brought with this, you know, being a genius. So I very much use examples of my own experiences and when I've messed up to explain to the children, there's nothing wrong with making mistakes. This is all that kind of growth mindset. You want children to embrace challenges. I think it's great for children to have at least one passion. I don't know if you know anything about the US college system, but you need like 15 different things. Like, I've climbed Kilimanjaro and I'm grade 9 on guitar and whatever. That's not real. I think kids need one thing aside from school. It could be more, great, but at least one thing that's their talent or something they enjoy. You don't need 10. And I suppose for younger kids, it's about giving them, opening them up to different things and then seeing which one they enjoy. So what I do with my kids, if they've signed up to an after school activity or a club or some kind of lessons, I'll say, I've paid for this term, so you are committed for the term. Then you can choose whether you want to continue. But I've had, you know, now they're older, I have those conversations. I mean, my son used to have guitar lessons. He hated it. And now I said, you can't learn in one lesson a week. You have to practice. If you're not going to practice, I'm not going to do it anymore. And then a few years later, because he was motivated, I now can't get him off his guitar, and it's electric and it's very loud. But it's got to come also from them. They need a bit of encouragement and pushing, but it's finding the right balance.
Yeah, sometimes it's the right activity at the wrong time. And as you say, if it is something they come back to, and the idea, obviously, the things we like, we tend to be good at, and vice versa. And we're prepared to be a bit more, have a bit more grip with them sometimes. But it's hard when we find the things that are tough to be persistent, and how long we spend doing that activity.
I've seen the tiger mum approach backfire big time.
Okay.
You know, children at 18, like, I never want to play that violin again. I'm going to burn it.
Yes, no, you know, so, you know, it's a delicate dance in terms of getting that decision right. I was going to ask you about, you talk a lot about it already, but the necessary skills for a child to learn for to be successful in the future in the workforce. You talked a bit about it already, but what are the key things? I mean, you mentioned EQ. What kind of things should children be by the time they're 18? What would you like an 18-year-old to walk into the world of work or maybe university and be able to cope with, if you like?
Yeah, well, I have to say, and I've thought this for a long time, that there needs to be considerable changes happening in education. And I hope this is going to be a catalyst, because I know Pearson set exams, but watching my kids go through GCSEs and A-levels, I'm just thinking, we haven't moved on. Like, the world's moved on in so many aspects, but it's still very reliant on rote learning. Even the new maths GCSE, they suddenly had to learn formulas off by heart, whereas they never did before. And it's all about applying your learning. So, and the truth is that a lot of jobs our children haven't even been invented. And it strikes me, you know, children in school are rewarded for following the rules, fitting a mould, cooperating, learning an exam syllabus off by heart. But the people who think outside the box and are the real innovators, they might be the kids that are neurodivergent, the ones that are really strong-willed and at school are considered to be disruptive or troublesome and highly sensitive. So it's like, what you need to succeed at work doesn't seem to be the same of what we judge to be success in school. So definitely EQ, definitely growth mindset, and the grit and the perseverance and curiosity, finding a genuine passion for ongoing learning. I would say a love of reading, absolutely key. Being authentic, knowing what are your goals and values instead of just being on this treadmill, having a good sense of what you're trying to achieve. And also, especially now, we've seen this sense of community and collective responsibility. I mean, that's why I go on about EQ, because communication is key. You know, being able to read other people's emotions. And a lot of the jobs going on now, that we're going to have robots, but robots are not going to have emotional intelligence like humans. So it's these real, genuine life skills that can count. And I think that business leaders and entrepreneurs, I don't know whether they are, but they should be consulted more on what the future workforce needs. And schools really should be, you know, guided by them, because they're seeing that they're dictating what they need. And I don't think that education, the standard education, has caught up with what's required.
Yeah, I often think, working in schools myself in the past, that unfortunately schools, I think, would like to do more of these wider skills, but the way they are measured is in a very narrow academic data-driven way from the government. And obviously the schools are dependent on those marks, and that's what they're going to focus on. So in a sense, it's sad that schools are measured in a particular way, and yeah, people respond to the way those things are measured.
They have pressure to meet those targets. Do you know about Howard Gardner's theory of multiple intelligences? There's 8 types of intelligences, and school really focuses on just logical, mathematical and linguistics, but leaves out all the other stuff, which is, you know, and I know teachers, they may not agree with it, but they've got this pressure to you know, keep to the curriculum and meet those targets.
Yes, definitely. In terms of obviously in the COVID-19 situation, and generally actually before this situation, there is rightly so a concern about children's mental health. And you talked about your children being less fear of missing out, in the sense that people aren't doing amazing things, or that appeared to be amazing things. What do you think we can do in terms of trying to, when we get back to whatever that new normal might be, what should we be doing in schools to improve children's mental health, do you think?
I think, you see, there's this perception that mental health is a much bigger issue now. And I'm confused about whether, I mean, even in my experience, the questions about, you know, anxiety in a 7-year-old or a child having low self-esteem, I'm getting way more questions about that than I did 20 years ago. But I also think, you know, studies show that the amount of children with mental health issues has increased. But I think it's that we are much more open and willing to talk about it. Just how children with learning disabilities, you know, in my generation, if you had dyslexia, you were just naughty. And now they realise that someone needs to be assessed and there is a reason why they're struggling to learn. So I think that we're diagnosing it a lot more. And schools are doing way more to support this. You know, I know a secondary school, they created this lovely room with a mental health first aider, a nurse that comes in, children can just knock on the door and speak to them at lunch break. I am concerned about whether this is going to exacerbate some mental health issues. And obviously, aside from, you know, so much has been focused on COVID-19, so loads of people are being neglected, whether that is cancer patients. It's already impossible to get an appointment with CAMHS. So just imagine the backlog of children who are not being seen. I used to think it's really ironic that social media was a big cause in teens for mental health issues and comparing themselves against others and all the rest of it. But ironically, that's the thing that has now saved children's mental health during this period, because they've been able to kind of communicate and replicate that feeling of, you know, being with their mates. So I'm just not quite sure what the outcome's going to be. For younger children, there may be issues with separation anxiety and knowing how to transition back to their old ways. But I think schools, whilst there's going to be a lot of pressure on teachers to get kids back up to the level, which is going to be a challenge, I still think that the social and emotional well-being, you know, even the schools, that the year groups that are going back in June, if that actually happens, there's going to be so much work on just making sure that they're comfortable and they're not anxious about the social distancing, and it's going to be a lot to deal with.
Let's change at once. Yeah. I was thinking about in terms of the work you do with companies earlier, and I was thinking that what are the key solutions you have in terms of when you talk to companies regarding childcare, and how can we promote, we talked about it earlier, but how can we promote that image that once you have children, you can, I kind of divide the care, I suppose, as we said earlier. What kind of, specifically when you talk about companies, is there anything you've done that's successful and you've seen a change in companies that's made a big difference, and the staff have reported back that they did this and we feel happier about it? Is there anything that you remember, anyone you worked with that linked to that kind of
idea? You know, I wouldn't be in business if what I was doing wasn't helping. And when I started, there's a job title which is diversity and inclusion or employee engagement. That didn't exist, you know, 19 years ago. So now any fairly decent sized business knows that if they want to keep their staff, I mean, I know people are worried about unemployment and you might feel you take any job, but really in the long run, to keep their staff engaged and happy and motivated, they need to look after them. So one thing that's very in common is employee networks. So there might be a parent and carers network or a LGBTQ network or a mental health network, wellbeing network. We do, you know, lots and lots of talks and encouraging internal networking and workshops, sharing stories of employees that have really made, you know, flexible or agile working work. And also, it's one thing having this kind of ethos or fancy statement on the company website, but in reality, does the company really support agile working? And one of the big barriers, I know of, there's been a lot of studies for working parents, and I hear this anecdotally, is that the company might have this positive, inclusive culture, but it really boils down to your relationship with your line manager. So I've also worked a lot in companies with giving line managers the tools to communicate effectively with parents and carers. Because if you're a line manager and you've not been a parent, or you haven't been through IVF or losing a child or your elderly relative falling down the stairs and you've got to go up to Aberdeen, you cannot begin to fathom how that person is feeling. And they've got their own, you know, challenges and board to report to. So there's a lot of work as well to help line managers understand the challenges that parents and carers are facing. So there's loads of work out there. And I'm having companies coming to me saying, look, this is like last year I worked with a construction company and they said only 20% of our employees are women and we're losing some great talent at the age when they have children. What is your solution for this? Or someone else, like a big tech company said, a global tech company said, we've got this back to business network. When people come back to work, whether it's from an illness or because they've had a child, how can we support them other than just saying, here's your desk, get on with it. So, you know, it's people are really homing in companies on which groups need support. And then it's up to people like me to come up with solutions and make sure that they genuinely feel supported.
Of course. We're running out of time now, and I'd like to ask you one final question relating to the COVID-19 and homeschooling. And you may not have these three answers, but I'm going to ask you anyway. I just would like to get your opinion and your thoughts on, we're in a unique situation. Ultimately, it's not going to last forever. Can you think of three things you would recommend parents do to their children that you think may be more difficult when things get back to normal, when the 9-to-5 starts again? Is there things that what opportunities should we be taking during this unique time that we're going to reflect back on in 5 years' time and think, I'm really glad I did that, and I look back at that in a positive way? What would you suggest parents do with their children in this unique time?
Okay, number one, I would say I have this idea which is called special time. And special time is allocating one-on-one, frequent, predictable, scheduled time for each parent to spend with each child, whether your child is 2 or 18. And I call this like vitamins for a child's soul. And it only needs to be 10 or 15 minutes, but there's no phones, there's no agenda, you're not trying to teach them something. You're just letting your child take the lead and just spending that really quality time. And this is something parents should do anyway, but maybe when they go back to work, it could only be, you know, 10 minutes once or twice a week. But taking the opportunity, because we're all with our kids, but are we really with them? I would say, I had it in my head, what were the other things I was gonna say? I would say also, focusing on helping children really, really understand that it's okay to feel however they want to feel. When kids behave in a certain way, we always react to their behavior, but really the behavior is just the tip of the iceberg. It's getting under the surface and saying, what all behavior is communication. What is my child trying to communicate to me? Take that moment to pause and think, what are the feelings and emotions driving this behavior? And helping your child learn how to manage and articulate those feelings, because that is a life skill, and loads more feelings than normal are going to be cropping up. And the other thing is, I would just say, just enjoy your kids, you know, have fun with them. Play is really the best way children learn, and adults as well. It's that feeling of being in full flow and losing track of time. We spontaneously last night after dinner, one of my kids put ABBA on and we were, you know, dancing around the living room, and it went on for an hour and it was just so much fun. Like, we've always got so much in our minds. So just, you know, enjoy your kids. Ask yourself when this is over, what is it my child is going to remember? And it's not you driving them mad to finish their schoolwork, but, you know, will they look back on this time as a period that they really enjoyed? And they really, the best thing to work on is your relationship and connection with your child.
Thank you very much. It was really a good conversation this afternoon. I thank you very much for your time today, Rachel.
Pleasure. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. Look out for more episodes coming soon.